Public Enemy. Since the heart of Public Enemy.
Hey everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, your host. Welcome. It's the Republic Broadcasting Network, and I should have a really good show lined up for you. Here in a few minutes, we're going to be talking to James Bamford, the author of A Pretext for War. And the way it's going to work on this show, folks, is foreign policy first. And the reason that I want to put foreign policy first is because I don't think that this massive Leviathan police state that we're creating in the United States can possibly be reversed until we end the state of warfare overseas. Years ago, someone asked me, oh, come on, they want to take all our freedom away. How could they ever take all our freedom away? We'd never stand for it. We're Americans. And I said, well, all they have to do is give us a foreign enemy, and we will be willing to give up our liberty. He said I was crazy, and of course, you know, turn it to C-SPAN right now. You'll see that turns out I was correct. So, as long as we're at war, we can't get rid of the Department of Homeland Security, we can't repeal the Patriot Act, we can't repeal the pieces of Patriot Act 2 that have already been passed. We're not really going to be able to get our country set back on the right path until we end our policy of perpetual war for perpetual peace. And so that's why I put foreign policy first on this show, and that's why I have as our guest today James Bamford. Probably most of you are familiar with him. He's the former Washington investigative producer for World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, and he's the author of the books The Puzzle Palace and Body of Secrets about the National Security Agency, and his new book is called A Pretext for War. Welcome to the show, sir.
Well, thanks very much.
It's an honor to have you on.
Well, I appreciate being here.
Okay, well, we only have a couple of minutes before our first little break here, so I think we'll just start out with, you know, the basic question I think that most media don't even try to really answer, but you pretty much come right out and answer this question in your book. The question is, why do they hate us, these terrorists that we're fighting?
Well, if you read most of the things that have been written by the terrorists or said by Osama bin Laden or read his fatwas or whatever, the primary reason for the hatred in the particularly in the Middle East, the most common denominator is the fact the U.S. Presence in the Middle East, and the fact that we've supported some of the worst dictators in the Middle East and backed Israel in their occupation of Palestine, backed it with billions of dollars, as well as the helicopters, the ammunition, and the political support. Those are the principal reasons. They want the United States to get out of the Middle East, stop supporting the worst dictators of the Middle East, and to leave the Palestine issue with Israel to be negotiated as opposed to supported.
I read something, I think just in the last week, where they were quoting Osama bin Laden as talking about all the terrible things America has done to us for the last 80 years. And I thought, 80 years? Hang on. And I started counting on my fingers, and I thought, oh, he's talking about the end of World War I. He's going back that far.
Well, I think he's going back to the Balfour Declaration, which was the declaration that the British government signed in, I think it was 1918 or 1917, which basically made Palestine a homeland for the Jews. That was part of what the Balfour Declaration was, and the British supported that, and I think that's where a lot of the if they say back 80 years, I think that's where they're taking it.
All right, our guest is James Bamford. It's the Weekend Interview Show. Stay tuned. All right. right, everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and on the phone is James Bamford. He's the author of A Pretext for War, and it's an excellent book. It goes into, it's got a few different sections. It goes into the inside story of the U.S. intelligence agencies and what they knew and what they weren't telling each other during the time leading up to the attack. It tells in-depth stories, including from people who were on the planes and in the towers of the attacks of September 11th. It has a pretty in-depth history of the Al-Qaeda network and the ties between the different terrorists. And also, the most important part, I think, is actually where the title comes from, about how a small group of intellectual neoconservatives took this country to war in Iraq. And hopefully toward the end of the interview we'll get to that part. I'd like to ask you, sir, about Ramzi Youssef and the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. Now, he's the nephew of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And now, were they already tied with Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network at this point, or they just kind of did that on their own?
No, not in 1993. They had, I don't think they had really much connection. They may have met him in Afghanistan around that time, but there was no organized Al-Qaeda connection that they were involved in at that time.
Well, the conventional wisdom is that these are religious fundamentalist extremist types who are out to get us, but Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi Youssef, they don't really strike me as the fundamentalist, pious, pray 10 times a day kind of guys.
Well, they weren't. They, matter of fact, after the bombing of the World Trade Center the first time, both of them went to the Philippines where they began helping one of the Philippine terrorist organizations, and during that time, Sheikh Mohammed basically became a womanizer. Wore a white tuxedo, went to some of the fancy nightclubs, and dated a lot of women down in the Philippines. So he's never been a sort of a religious fanatic or tied real closely to any particular religious dogma. It was mostly hatred of America for its foreign policy as opposed to any religious reasons.
There's a story in your book. You talk about a massacre at the Qana refugee camp by Israel, a refugee camp in Lebanon, I believe. And I've never even heard of this story before, and yet in your book you say this is really pivotal to the formation of Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, there was a very large attack by Israel on a number of installations in southern Lebanon, and it made a large impression actually upon a lot of people. It was front page news in the European press, British press, European press, and one of the people who I think won one of the major journalism awards for his reporting on that was Fisk, I forgot his first name.
Oh, Robert Fisk.
Robert Fisk,
at the Independent.
Who writes for the Independent, and he described the battle because he was there and described the massacre, and it was extremely bloody and very one-sided, and that angered enormous numbers of Muslims, Arabs in the Middle East because it was extremely heavily covered there. Israel shot a missile at an ambulance and a number of other things like that. So Bin Laden, if you read his fatwas and his statements around that period of time and from then on, he frequently mentions Qana during those times. So it was a very inflaming incident in terms of his own development of his hatred for the United States and as well for other people throughout the Middle East.
And what year was that?
I think it was 1996.
Okay, so this takes place after the Bojinka plot in the Philippines of Ramzi Youssef and Abdul Hakim Murad.
That's right, yeah. They were really unconnected in terms of those two plots were unconnected. The connection was that Bin Laden was living in the Sudan, then he wanted to go back to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia denied him permission to come back, and the U.S. was putting pressure on the Sudan to get rid of Bin Laden, and due to all the pressure, Bin Laden decided to leave and go to Afghanistan. And it was around that time that the actually he stopped, I think, in Qatar at the time on the way to Afghanistan. It was right around that time. I think it was April of 96 that it took place, and that was a major factor in Bin Laden's thinking, and he mentioned it numerous times as one of the causes for his hatred of the United States' support for Israel and Israel's invasion at that time.
Lieutenant Colonel Karen Katowski made a comment one time about how the Wahhabist, fundamentalist, extremist Sunnis in the Middle East, that they're sort of the neoconservatives of the Middle East. That is, nobody listens to them until all hell breaks loose. And once things are on fire and people are being blown apart, all of a sudden people are more willing to listen to what the Wahhabists have to say. Not unlike we're willing to listen to Paul Wolfowitz after some towers fall down in our country.
Well, in the sense that they're both extreme, hold extremist views, I think that's true. I think they're sort of opposites in terms of their philosophy, but in a sense they're both fundamentalists and hold these views which are far from the mainstream. The problem is in the United States, these people who held these views, the neoconservatives, were put in a position of great power and great authority, and that's one of the reasons we were in the Iraq War right now.
On page 210 in your book, you say, in the end, the only winner was Osama bin Laden. All along, his goal and that of his top leadership was to draw the United States deeper and deeper into the sinkhole of a war in the Middle East. Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's close associate and confidant, argued that al-Qaeda should bring the war to the distant enemy in order to provoke the Americans to strike back and personally wage the battle against the Muslims. So, it's not that they're really trying to get us to leave the Middle East, it's that they're trying to suck us in?
No, they want us out of the Middle East, but they believe that the United States has already declared war on them in the Middle East, and they've been doing it remotely from the United States with money and political support for leaders of Saudi Arabia and other places, as well as positioning U.S. Military over there. And what obviously that they wanted, from if you read their comments, Zawahiri and bin Laden and so forth, was to have an actual war against them. They're you know, handful of people can't have a war against the United States, and what they were hoping for was to provoke a war between the United States and many of the people in the Middle East. And if you're attacking the United States and you blow up a few buildings, attack a ship or the embassies and so forth, you're not really affecting the United States as a whole. But if you get provoke the United States into a war such as in Vietnam, where the United States ended up basically losing that war and then leaving in disgrace, which is largely what happened. The United States basically just gave up after we lost 50,000 people over there. I think that was more, I think that's more, if you read the writings and the statements, it's more what they wanted than just simply blowing up a few things. They wanted to provoke a war in which the United States would ultimately be defeated as in Vietnam. And that's, if that was their goal, they're probably very happy about what the turnout has been so far.
Well, Mike Schurer, the anonymous CIA agent, who I guess is not so anonymous, who wrote the book Imperial Hubris, he was quoted recently as saying that the Iraq invasion is a gift to al-Qaeda. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree mostly with what there are two points he makes. I agree with his first point, which is very similar to the issues I've just been saying, which is that the reasons for the hatred and the probably the satisfaction that they have in generating the United States to get involved in this quagmire over there. I think I agree with what he says, which is similar to what I've been saying. I don't agree with his other point, which is pretty much that the solution is to kill as many of them as possible. I think there's other ways of doing this short of that, but in terms of the reason that they hate us and the reason we're involved in this, I do agree with that.
Well, and I think he qualified. I know that the NBC cut of his interview would leave one to believe that, but from what I've been able to tell, he seems to be saying that, look, either we can stop meddling in the Middle East, or we can start killing as many of these guys as we can, but we can't have neither. It's got to be one or the other.
That's right, yeah. Right, and I agree with the first point, that we should stop meddling in the Middle East. It's easier. You can have the United States be a superpower, play a major role in the world, without micromanaging every aspect of what's going on in the Middle East. For example, it might be advantageous for the United States to have had a presence in the Middle East in case there was an attack. Suppose, you know, if you want to have the United States have a presence in the Middle East, there was an easier way of doing it than basing all these military people in Saudi Arabia, which obviously was a trigger point. You could have simply put them on two aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean and never bothered anybody. The Cold War was over. We had aircraft carriers to spare, and you could have put them on there, and nobody would have been offended.
All right. The guest is James Bamford. The book is A Pretext for War. It's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and our guest today is James Bamford. He's the author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and his latest, A Pretext for War. Now, sir, right before the break, you were saying that we could have had our, you know, if we really wanted to have a military presence in the Middle East, we could have just kept them on aircraft carriers out in the middle of the ocean, but that basing our troops in Saudi Arabia between the two Iraq wars, that was a major trigger for Al-Qaeda. Is that right?
Well, that's right, and it was obvious from the statements that were made by many of the people in the Middle East that they didn't like the fact that the U.S. was had a presence in the holiest of places for the Muslim world. And the U.S. could have easily had a presence in the Middle East if we had put the people on, if we just based two aircraft carriers in the Indian Ocean, and we also had a base not that far away on Diego Garcia, which was a British, an island in the Indian Ocean that was owned by Britain that was leased to the United States for military uses. So we had a lot of areas there where we could have had a presence without either offending a lot of Arab sensibilities and also without seeming to support the Saudi royal family.
Well, it's come out from Paul O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury, and Rich Clark, the former Director of Counterterrorism, that the Bush administration wanted a war against Iraq all along, from the moment they took power, and that immediately, even on the day of September 11th and the next day, plans were already being laid for attacking Iraq. Why do you think that is? What exactly is motivating that?
Well, there's two factors, I think. The first one is that the people who were the architects of the war, who basically were the people who occupied the senior positions at the Pentagon and in Vice President Cheney's office, had been planning for this war for years. At least since 1996, there was a... three of the members of that group, Richard Perle, Douglas Fife, and David Woomser, drafted a plan for Israel in 1996 to overthrow Saddam Hussein and replace him with basically a puppet who was friendly to both Israel and the United States.
And this is a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm that they wrote for Benjamin Netanyahu, actually, right?
That's right. This was in 1996, and they were working as consultants for Benjamin Netanyahu, who had recently been elected as Prime Minister of Israel, and Pearl, Wurmser, and Fife were part of a small group who drafted this plan called, which they named A Clean Break, and part of that plan involved overthrowing the Saddam government and replacing Saddam Hussein with, like I said, a puppet friendly to the United States and Israel. The person they had in mind, obviously, was Ahmed Chalabi, who had been a friend of theirs, a friend of the neocons for a very long time.
And now it turns out was working for Iran.
If the allegations are true, he apparently was giving some very valuable secrets to the Iranian government, if he was in the United States, he would have been arrested for espionage at that point. But so they came up with a plan, and Richard Pearl hand-deliver the plan to Netanyahu. Netanyahu wisely put it in the bottom drawer and never looked at it again. They never acted upon the plan. But it was still active in the minds of Wurmser, Pearl, and Fife, and when they took office as senior officials in the Bush administration, they basically brought it to life. One of those people, David Wurmser, actually wrote a paper in January of 2001, which he advocated the United States and Israel jointly launching a Middle East war. And one of the lines in that document that he wrote, at the time he was at the American Enterprise Institute, said crises are opportunities. And apparently they used 9-1-1 as that crisis for an opportunity, the opportunity being to enact what in essence was the Clean Break Plan. So on the very day of September 11th, you have Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld actually saying, as one of his aides wrote down notes where he was saying, expand this to bring in Saddam Hussein, even though all the evidence was pointing to Osama bin Laden.
Right, things related and not sweep it all up.
That's right, yeah.
And by sweep it up, he means shatter everything into a million pieces.
Well, sweep it all up, and in other words, expand it beyond just Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda to everybody they don't like in the Middle East, beginning with Saddam Hussein, even though there was no evidence that Saddam Hussein had any connection with September 11th. He wanted to sweep him up along with Al-Qaeda and bin Laden in any retaliation that came out of September 11th.
All right, it's the Weekend Interview Show. Our guest is James Bamford, and it's the Republic Broadcasting Network. We'll be right back. Everybody, welcome back to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton, and my guest today is author James Bamford. He wrote the book A Pretext for War. And before the break started there, sir, you were talking about how Iraq had nothing to do with the attack of September 11th, and how despite that fact, the highest levels of the administration were already kicking into gear and working out an excuse to attack them. And which brings up, you said the American Enterprise Institute there a second ago. I wonder, what do you think of the theories of Lori Milroy and her book, Saddam Hussein's Unfinished War with the United States, and all the accusations about Ramzi Youssef and others associated being actually tied to the Saddam Hussein regime?
Well, it's just basically crackpot journalism, crazy right-wing conspiracy theories, and the problem is you have crazy right-wing neoconservatives in office, so they're going to believe the all the crazy right-wing neoconservative conspiracy theories. And she's the author of a lot of those theories, and the people in the administration have sort of lashed upon a lot of those.
It's funny because, you know, a lot of right-wing conspiracy theories nowadays are about her and about the American Enterprise Institute.
Well,
from the other angle.
Right, exactly, yeah. And I think they, back during the Reagan administration, Claire Sterling wrote a book that tried to show a Soviet connection to the assassination of the Pope and so forth, and that was lashed upon by a lot of the conservatives and neoconservatives back then. I think the that's the same way that's happening now. I think there was a big effort to try to show that there was a connection between Ramzi Youssef and Saddam Hussein and the first World Trade Center attack, and there's never been any evidence from any source that shows that there was that connection, and almost every investigation that's ever looked into that has said that there's no connection, but still, that's one of the tenets of this this conspiracy theory.
Another motive that you identify in your book is the alleged assassination attempt against George Bush Sr. and Laura Bush in Kuwait in 1993, and I believe you quote our chief executive as saying, "He tried to kill my daddy," as one of the reasons for the war against Iraq. Is that right?
Yeah, he's said either that or similar comments a number of times over the years, showing his great animosity towards Saddam Hussein, which is really understandable. The problem is, whatever your personal views are, you shouldn't act out upon him as president of the United States.
And that assassination attempt was all bunk anyway. That wasn't even true, was it?
Yeah, but I didn't really get into that. Seymour Hersh has written a lot about that. For my purposes, it doesn't really make any difference. It's what George W. Bush believed, and he believed the information to be true, and that's what really counts. Whether it was true or not is almost beside the point. It's what George W. Bush believed, and what he believed was basically what was told to him by the Justice Department, and the Justice Department in their report indicated that it wasn't just his father that would have been killed. It would have been virtually his entire immediate family, his father, his mother, his wife, his two brothers and their wives, or two of his brothers and their wives. And that's because they were all traveling together, and they all would have been on the stage together when the bomb would have gone off. So you have George W. Bush, who looks at Saddam Hussein as not only being sort of a leftover problem from his father's previous administration, he's also somebody who tried to kill all his immediate family. So going into office, he had this enormous amount of animosity, which he vocalized a number of times. So you combine that with the neoconservative anti-Saddam, anti-Iraq involvement in prior years, getting together at that first National Security Council meeting on January 30th, 2001. And what you end up having is the only two topics of conversation during that National Security Council meeting was, number one, going easier on Israel, becoming more friendly towards Ariel Sharon, and at the same time finding ways to go about attacking Iraq.
Well, just for the record, I've actually interviewed Frederick Whitehurst, the former director of the FBI crime lab, and he said that they lied about the explosive. He determined what kind of explosive it was in that so-called assassination attempt, and they came out and said it was an entirely different kind of explosive so they could pretend to match it from something from Iraq, or match it to something from Iraq, just for the record. That was,
right, yeah, know. No, I touch on those, some of those aspects in the book, but the, you know, for the point of why we went to war with Iraq, it's what was in George W. Bush's mind, not what the reality, which is often the case.
Right. You also write in your book, I thought this was an interesting point, and I think it also illustrates the split between the mainline American foreign policy establishment and the neoconservatives. You write in your book about how many considered Saddam Hussein a stabilizing force in the region. He was not a threat that was about to, you know, destroy all peace and security in the area. He was actually a stabilizing force. In fact, I think I remember 1997, Fareed Zakariyyeh, who I think is on This Week with George Stephanopoulos nowadays.
And he writes a column for Newsweek.
Yeah, there you go. Fareed Zakariyyeh said, in fact, I think it was in Newsweek, that if Saddam Hussein did not exist, we would have to invent him. He is the linchpin of our foreign policy in the Middle East.
Well, the prior Reagan and Bush administration certainly thought so. We not only gave him moral support, we gave him intelligence support, and including the precursors of biological weapons, which we ended up using as one of the reasons for launching the war in Iraq. That all that friendship and cooperation, intelligence, and germ warfare was given to him, or at least the precursors, the germs, were given to him during the Reagan and early Bush administration. So, in addition, yeah, he was a stabilizing force, the same way Tito was a stabilizing force in Yugoslavia, holding these divergent ethnic groups together in a sort of a cohesive whole. And Saddam Hussein was holding the three groups, the Sunnis, the Shiites, and the Kurds together. So he was a despicable leader, which the United States supported during the early Bush and Reagan administration. But he was a threat internally to his own people, like a lot of other dictators around the world, but he certainly was not a threat to the United States. During the after the UN, after the Gulf War, in the early 90s, the UN went in and destroyed virtually all of the weapons of mass destruction that he had, and Saddam Hussein turned instead to constructing palaces of mass luxury as opposed to weapons of mass destruction, and that's what a lot of people in the intelligence community were saying prior to the invasion.
Well, and that really brings up the Office of Special Plans and the Pentagon and the neoconservatives, their own little intelligence agency that they created, because, like you're saying, the conclusion of the mainline intelligence agencies was there's nothing there, right?
Yes, that's right. And I interviewed a number of people at the intelligence agencies. Actually, prior to the war, I wrote three op-ed pieces in August, September, and October, saying the people I've interviewed said they don't see any evidence of weapons of mass destruction over there. The whole idea was that you would send the inspectors over there. The inspectors would do their job, and when they concluded their job, they would either say that they found evidence or they didn't find evidence. And the problem was the Bush administration, it wasn't Saddam who threw the weapons inspectors out. It was Bush who threw the weapons inspectors out before they completed their job. So the problem was the White House wanted to go to war. The Pentagon wanted to go to war. The CIA wasn't being very cooperative because they weren't coming up with the hard evidence showing that these, number one, that CIA wasn't showing evidence that there were weapons of mass destruction over there, and number two, they weren't showing any links between Saddam and Al-Qaeda. So that's why the Pentagon set up their own special little ad hoc intelligence unit, and that was run by this guy David Wurmser, who again was one of the principal architects of the Clean Break Report in 1996 given to Israel. So Wurmser set up this little unit in the Pentagon to cherry pick intelligence. In other words, you get a report in with 10 pieces of evidence indicating there aren't weapons of mass destruction and one little piece indicating there might be. He'd ignore all the ignore the 9 other pieces and take the one little questionable piece and add that together with lots of other questionable pieces and give distorted intelligence, and that's basically what happened. So they were pumped. While the CIA, at least initially, was pumping out correct intelligence, it was this little unit in the Pentagon that was pumping out all this distorted intelligence, and that was what they were using to go on.
And you say in your book, and this is something that, as far as I can tell, and I've studied this as much as I can, and the only places I can find this is in your book, in one article in The Guardian, and something written for, I don't remember if it was for The Nation or what, by a reporter named Bob Dreyfus, about the fact, or the accusation at least, that Ariel Sharon was having the exact same problem with the Mossad, and that, in fact, he created the Office of Special Plans inside his own office, first in Israel, and then that the Office of Special Plans in the Pentagon was a subsidiary or a branch off of that operation.
Yeah, there was an article in The Guardian about that, but there are many other factors that sort of pointed in those directions. First of all, there was a study that, or several studies that were done after the initial invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. A couple of studies done in Israel. One of the principal ones was done by at this sort of military think tank or strategic think tank at, I think it's the University of Tel Aviv, and one of those universities over there. And the conclusion was that Israel had no better intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction before the war than the United States did. They knew as little about it as the United States did. Yet, at the same time, the study concluded, and the study was done by a former Israeli general, the hype that was coming out was very similar to the hype that was coming out of the United States. The Israeli government was hyping up the fact that there were all these weapons of mass destruction in the United States needed to do something about it. Ariel Sharon, in August of 2002, prior to the war, his office was issuing press releases saying that the United States shouldn't wait. The United States should invade immediately. And so there was all this pressure. At the same time, there were many visits by Israeli senior military Israeli leaders, generals, and so forth, to the Pentagon to visit the fight very secretly. And so you have all these things taking place prior to the war, and yet there was, and there still is, very little investigation by the U.S. press into any connections between Israel and the United States and in the lead up to the war. And then you have on top of that, as you mentioned, the report in the Guardian indicating Ariel Sharon set up a similar little office of special plans to sort of cherry pick intelligence, and that intelligence was supposedly shared or apparently shared with the United States. And if you hear some of the comments by some of the senior U.S. officials, both intelligence and military and White House, in the past few months or the months after the initial invasion, when they're trying to make excuses for why they can't find weapons of mass destruction, numerous times they said it wasn't only a mistake of the United States. Other intelligence agencies, without specifying any particular names, also had similar information, and the indications are that they're one of those countries, at least, was Israel.
Oh, no, surely they're just referring to Great Britain.
No, it's plural, and there's more than one country they're referring to, and the two countries we were getting the most intelligence from at the time were Britain and Israel.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with James Bamford. He's the author of the book, A Pretext for War. Can I ask you about Saddam Hussein's peace deal? Do you know about that? His offer to Richard Pearl?
Right, yeah. I didn't write a lot about that because there had been a lot written about it at the time, and I didn't have any original sources on it, so I didn't include much of it in the book. But I'm vaguely familiar with that peace overture that was made.
Now, the best way I understand it is that Saddam Hussein apparently didn't have any idea what this war was about any more than anybody else. And so basically he said, look, if this is about oil, I'll give you my mineral rights. If this is about Israel, we'll switch sides in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. If this is about democracy, we'll hold elections in 2 years monitored by you and the French. If this is about weapons of mass destruction, which, yeah, right, but if it is, go ahead and send in thousands of FBI agents and army troops, and we'll let them look around wherever they want. That's basically the substance of his offer, right?
Yeah, I was paying more attention to the intelligence aspect, so I specifically remember him saying, in terms of weapons of mass destruction, I think he referred actually to the CIA. He said, send as many CIA agents over as you want. And ironically, of all the countries in the world, we have more intelligence agents in Iraq at that moment than anywhere else on Earth. They had full access to go everywhere they could go to look for whatever they wanted to look for. And the U.S. had a list of possible sites, and instead of having them go there and look at those sites, they pulled them out, and we went to war.
All right, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm Scott Horton. The guest is James Bamford, the author of A Pretext for War. We'll be right back. Everybody, it's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Scott Horton, and on the phone is James Bamford. He's the author of an excellent book called A Pretext for War. Mr. Bamford, please forgive me if this sounds silly, but I've been watching the cable news, and it seems like they're having this debate still about whether or not the Bush administration knew that they were lying when they said all of those ridiculous lies about Iraq's ties to Al-Qaeda and their stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction. And, for example, to hear Bill O'Reilly tell it, well, they thought what they were saying was true, but it was based on bad information, and they didn't know that. What's your opinion of that?
Well, actually, the CIA was giving them the correct information for a long time, there was no indication that there were weapons of mass destruction. A perfect example of that was when the president wanted to indicate that Saddam Hussein was getting nuclear materials from Niger. The CIA was telling the White House that there is no evidence that he was getting nuclear material, uranium, from Niger. And George Tenet succeeded, the director of the CIA, succeeded in getting them to delete it from the speech the president gave to the nation in Cincinnati, but they insisted on putting it back in for his State of the Union speech. And by then, George Tenet had sort of thrown up his hands and decided he was going to join the team as opposed to fighting it. So
And for his trouble, he got all the blame.
Exactly, and the CIA, so there's an example of the CIA telling the White House that no, there is no indication that he got this, and yet the president's saying the opposite to the nation. So I don't know how you define a lie, but if you get your intelligence director saying that it's not true and you go ahead and you say it anyway, to me that sounds like a lie.
Is America safer?
No, I think America's in far worse shape now than it's ever been before in terms of the way it's looked upon by the rest of the world and the way it's vulnerable to terrorists.
Now, you're not just some partisan Democrat, are you?
No, I my writings, all the writings I've ever done, have all been nonpartisan. I've written 3 books on the intelligence community, and none of them have had a political slant at all. I don't take part in any political parties. I don't support any particular group. I've never had anything to do with politics. So, my views are my views, but they're based on the way I view intelligence, not the way I view politics.
Well, so if whoever becomes president, whichever of the two wins, And if they decide to make you the chief of counterterrorism, how would you recommend to them that the war on terrorism actually be fought as opposed to the way it's being fought now?
Well, first of all, I would say that, number one, you've got to start changing the U.S. Foreign policy in the Middle East and make it a rational policy based on, you know, the way it would be acceptable around the world rather than just acceptable to certain political interest groups. And that's number one. And number two, I would I think I'd have a far more rational policy to defending the United States rather than squandering billions of dollars on building higher fences and increasing the hatred of the United States around the world.
All right, everybody. James Bamford, he's the author of The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and his latest, A Pretext for War. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Mr. Bamford.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's the Weekend Interview Show. We'll be right back.